Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 157 of Registry Matters. Larry, it is yet another Saturday night, and you have decided to grace us with your presence again.
I get roped into this every single week.
You think you would learn by now?
You'd think so.
But obviously not. Anyway, what do we have going on this evening?
We have some audience participation, and we have a case out of the Ninth Circuit. But mostly it's just going to be the audience participation in a case review.
So, tell us about what case you're talking about there.
We're talking about the case of Does, John and Jane, number 1 through 134, versus Lawrence. Yeah, isn't that something? Versus Lawrence Wasden, the Attorney General of the State of Idaho, and like dozens of other defendants. We're talking about that case just decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we're going to dig into it a little bit in terms of what the Ninth Circuit decided, so you don't want to tune out just yet.
Excellent. I guess then with that said, we can just dive right into that participation thing you were just alluding to. The first question comes to us and reads, I really enjoy all of your podcasts and appreciate everything you both do for the PFRs. The question that I have is what, if any, difference it is as if it's a federal case. I will be going to federal prison soon for receipt of CP and would like to one day exit federal prison to a PNW state. I'll ask you about that in a second. I am curious when I am on federal supervised release if the same interstate compact exists. Also, for future podcasts, can you mention if something will be different for a federal case than a state case? What in the flippity flip is a PNW state?
I was hoping you would be able to explain that because I wasn't clear either.
I don't have any references to it. I don't know what a PN. I mean, let's see here. Person notwithstanding state? That's probably not it. Neutered women? I don't know what this would be. Pacific Northwest. Smart person in chat helped us. Thank you. That's probably right. Pacific Northwest state. That makes sense, Larry.
Well, that's why we have this vast audience of ours.
All right. So somebody is going to federal prison soon for receipt of CP, and they would like to one day exit federal prison to a Pacific Northwest state. That makes a lot more sense now. So what is the difference between federal charges and state charges as far as transferring supervision?
It's a great deal easier because the U.S. government is one sovereign, and the federal law is uniform. So you don't have 50 separate sovereigns plus the territories who've had to make an agreement among themselves. So when you're in federal custody, you're likely going to be released to where you were convicted, but that's not a given because of the nature of the system. It's one America. It would be like if you were in Canada, where rather than having having 50 separate sovereigns, it's an interprovincial transfer in Canada. So if you get accused of a crime in a Canadian province, it's a crime against the crown, and it doesn't matter which province you're in. Well, the same thing in the federal system. You can be released anywhere, but oftentimes, and I'm not a federal expert, so I'm gonna say this is take this with a grain of whatever they say, salt, right?
Sure.
But you're gonna be offered to be released to the jurisdiction of where you were convicted, but that doesn't mean you have to remain there or even be released there. My understanding is that you can propose to through the process because months before you're going to be released from federal prison, they begin the process. You know, you're going to have some time in a halfway house or some form of reintegration, And actually, we've got Brenda in chat, and she recently went through it in the last 3-4 years. But there's participation in terms of where the what the person proposes as their living arrangements when they get out, and it's not all that complicated to move them to another jurisdiction. What gets a little bit more complicated is the jurisdiction for the case itself. If you were sentenced in Georgia and you move to Idaho, there's a federal court in Idaho, but there's some process that I'm not expert enough to try to explain where you actually move the jurisdiction of the case. So if you violate your supervised release, as they refer to it, that it could be handled by the judge in Idaho rather than having to go back to Georgia. But I don't know enough to explain how that process works. But the jurisdiction of the court can be switched as well, because the U.S. is still just one sovereign.
What about, so I knew that there was a comment coming from someone in chat that has federal charges. It says Fed chiming in, to transfer, you need proof of appropriate residence and usual community ties. Otherwise, you're released to the district in which you were charged. Well, that's just the release part. We're asking about getting transferred somewhere else. What about the registry side of it, Larry? What about, specifically, I'm thinking of a place like Florida where you end up on the registry there for life, though you're charges were federal, but you get snookered into their registry and then you move to somewhere else. I'm assuming you still stay on the Florida registry.
That's my understanding, but your registry requirements would be wherever you're living. And as I keep telling the people, and it drives them bananas, you may be on Florida's list, but you're not registering with Florida. You're not reporting to anybody. You don't have any obligations. You're not paying any money. You're not having any restrictions of Florida law imposed on you about 2,500 feet of this. All it is, and I'm not minimizing when I say all, but all it actually is that they are keeping your likeness on the website. So you may have a 5, 10, 15, 20, 30-year-old picture, the last picture they have in their collection of you. But you're not technically registering in Florida. You're listed on Florida's website. And it generally shows you're living out of state, and it'll give the state of the last place that has reported to them that they've registered you. It'll say living out of state, New Mexico, living out of state, whatever.
And not continuing to go update. I mean, because that would be, can you imagine like 72 hours within, you know, prior to your birthday, you have to then trek over to Florida to go update your registry. It's not that way is what I'm going after.
That is correct. Now, we do have the state of Wisconsin who sends you your form when you're out of state, and they tell you to send in your $100, I believe.
That's
it is.
Right.
And people dutifully do that. I would not be able to force myself to do that, but there are people who and there are some who don't. Everybody doesn't send in the $100, but there's a combination of people who laugh at it, and there's people who send in the $100. As far as I know, that's the only state that tries to continue to assert jurisdiction over you in terms of you still have to comply with our registry, even though you're no longer here.
That yeah, I was like, when we covered that whole thing of people that still send in that money, that's kind of amusing. And I'm not surprised, Larry, that you being the renegade that you are, that you would be like, FYP, I am not sending you that money.
Well, that's one of the ways you could have a test case to find out if they have the constitutional authority. And someone did send us a case which did not support their supposition, you know, their assertion that it was nuanced. But I did look at a case that someone said that had already been decided that they have jurisdiction. But I could easily distinguish that if I wanted to make the argument, so that case wouldn't worry me if I were needing to litigate this.
Very well. I don't think we need to dig around this one any longer. Ready to move on?
Sure.
All right. This one is sort of like War and Peace. It says, question about a comment Larry made fairly early on in 156, namely the idea of not being able to forward a message or portion of it to an inmate in prison due to rules prohibiting acting as a conduit. I ask about this because I'm currently corresponding with 3 inmates at 3 different facilities, one of them a federal institution. These particular guys are known to each other and having been roommates at one point or another. Sometimes they ask me to relay greetings or short letters because they believe they would not be allowed to communicate directly. Until your comment, I frankly hadn't even given it any thought, and I just sent them on. They are completely innocuous communications, and I can't imagine anyone objecting. But now you've got me wondering if I might be running afoul of some policy, or worse, some law. I tried a few internet searches, but couldn't really come up with anything useful. I was in prison in the early 90s in Tennessee, where I regularly corresponded with other inmates, both in county jails and other prisons in Tennessee. Of course, we always understood our mail was opened and inspected and therefore possibly read in detail, but the things we're just communicating were no kind of security threat or anything that would have caused anyone concern, so generally, we didn't care. Anyway, I'm just wondering about the specific rules you are aware of regarding this topic and what level they lie, that is, institutional policy, state or federal department policy, or legal statute. Please advise. By the way, love the podcast. I am a low-level patron, but thank you anyway for being a patron. FYP to appropriate parties, et cetera.
Et cetera.
Well, someone criticized me for saying et cetera. So I don't do that anymore.
I remember that person. I do not know of any law that says that you can't do that. But I'm looking at it through a prism slightly different than what he would need to look at it. We're looking at it as the publisher of the transcript, as the podcast goes, and we want prisoners to have access to the transcripts, and we don't want to give the institutions any reason to say no. So therefore, we're very careful about what we do. As I think I said on a podcast a couple back, that prison administration would have a hard time finding any fault with us because we try to be factual and we try to be fair. And so relaying messages would be frowned on by most prison management. And they do that because they frown on it because they're very good at analyzing cryptic messages. But even though they're good at it, they don't get everything. And prisoners are very adept at communicating in cryptic messages. And therefore, since I don't have any interest in trying to decipher cryptic messages and figure out if there's anything in there, I choose, just as a matter of policy of the Registry of Matters podcast, that we're not going to be in that business at all. Sure. That way they won't be able to say that. And as smart as you think you are, prisoners will have nothing but time on their hands, can figure out ways to outsmart almost everyone. That's just a given. And so therefore there could be hidden messages, and there are very unique ways of trying to sneak contraband in prisons. That's the reason why so many prisons are scanning mail these days rather than actually handing off the correspondence. I just don't want there to be any doubt about where we're up to. We're trying to provide information to people who don't have access to what we're doing, and we don't want prison administrators to think that we're trying to subvert or any way help prisoners communicate with one another. But in terms of him doing that, I don't think there's anything that he has to fear unless there's an escape plot or something that would be adverse to institutional security that he passed on. And it turned out that they wanted to come talk to him because he was the originator of that correspondence, and then when they finally did decipher it. But it's just, I'm a cautious person by nature, and I don't want to get in the middle of something like that, so I choose not to do it.
So like every fifth word of the letter is like the plans on how to work through the tunnel system of the institution.
Well, it wouldn't even have to be that sinister. It could be anything in terms of just trying to, administrators do not want you trying to organize prisoners because they see that as a threat. Yeah, I mean, it's the reality of it. If I've never run a prison, so I can't tell you why they think that way. But it's like companies that are anti-union. Try organizing a union and see how long you last when they get word that's what you're doing. Well, prison administrators do not, they're not favorable to inmates trying to organize in any way. They do everything they can to infiltrate and figure out what they're up to. So I just choose that it's the best policy that the podcast be as direct as it is, and it's an informational source for people that have legitimate needs to know this, what we're doing, and we're not a conduit to help people communicate. And we're really sorry that we can't do that, but that's the policy until we can think of some reason why it should be altered.
Groovy. All right, then I'm pretty sure this came in from Super Patron Mike. Pretty sure. And he says, Larry, in the news, the term latches is being used. Please explain to our unlegal minds what this legal term is and why it is important to court cases. Thank you. Oh, great one. Also, thank you, Andy. You guys rock. I have no idea what this one is about.
And I, since I didn't read that question prior, I think we should come back to it. But it has to do with timelessness, as I recall. It's a doctrine of timeliness. But we can come back to it a little bit later.
Oh, okay. All right, then. And then this is mostly a comment that was received over on the Discord server. And let me just point out that someone asked me about listening to the show live. And I just want to tell you that if you become a patron, then you can head over to our Discord server and listen to us record it live. Otherwise, you can just ask me and I'll probably let you in. But it is mostly for the Patreon supporters, to whom I thank very much for being Patreon supporters. And this says, "Hi, Andy, this is Derek, a fairly new Patreon supporter. I wanted really to thank you and Larry for all the hard work and dedication you put into the podcast each and every week. I learn so much from each episode, even on issues that do not directly impact me. It's very insightful, and it's caused me to definitely look at moving to Vermont or Washington State once I'm finished with my probation in a little over a year. Currently, I'm on an interstate compact in Texas from California because my family lives here. They've been wonderful and supportive throughout this whole ordeal, and I feel like I've been blessed. They are also supportive of me going somewhere where I stand a better chance of getting off with a registration, even if that means I'm far away from them. Per last week, I don't understand why anyone would want to live in a state like Mississippi that is so prohibitive. I know there's personal reasons, but I just can't fathom why those reasons run so deep. Anyway, keep up the good work, and thank you again." Do you want to revisit talking about Sissamippi again, or any state that is just super crappy?
Well, I can't imagine that a person would want to leave the South to go to live with a bunch of heathens, liberals, airheads. I mean, this is just shocking to me. Yeah, this is, I mean, these people are something else. I mean, but Mississippi is that group of southern states that are just, first of all, it's not a very attractive state in terms of economic opportunity. It's 48th, 49th, and 50th in everything that's worthwhile to measure.
Yep.
And the laws are particularly oppressive in terms of the penalties they impose and the registry requirements. I think I mentioned on the podcast recently that we had a head registry official from a large county in Mississippi contacted us a few years ago.
Yeah.
And said, "When are you people going to come down here and do something?" And just recently, they passed a law that took effect that without a court order, that you can't have any communication in any fashion with your victim. And like one of our people that does a lot of volunteer work for NARSL, it affects a familial relationship that's been healed and happy and healthy for many years. And that should be litigated. Trying to find ways to litigate that has been challenging because the attorneys see it as so hopeless. You know, the litigation doesn't fare well in Mississippi. But I would encourage him, actually, I was being tongue-in-cheek, I would encourage anybody to evaluate what your chances are of success in these oppressive states. And if you have the option to look at other options, option to look at other alternatives, that would be what I would do myself. I would not stay in Mississippi and Louisiana unless I had no choice.
I understand. It's also a really flat state, Larry. Like, you drive across I-10 across the southern part, and it is a straight line all the way across, and there's no up or down.
Is that right?
It is pretty. It's pretty flat, for real. There's some hills up there, I guess, by Huntsville and whatnot, but otherwise, it's All right, so don't move to Mississippi. That's the end. And I'm surprised of moving California's lifetime registration. So, like, it doesn't California kind of doesn't fit the blue model of being a better place? And I'm super painting broad brushes for moving from California to Texas. Texas is a pretty rough place to be too.
Well, California, remember, it hasn't been blue that long. People forget about that. They act as if it's always been a bastion of liberalism, but we had California Governor Ronald Reagan. We had California Governor George Duke Mason. We had California Governor Pete Wilson. We had California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. We've had on and on with Republican governors in California. Now, it has been heavily blue for the last decade or so. For the last 15 years, it's been heavily blue. And that has not made it a panacea. They've made some mistakes as blue states, but they have also a problem that many states don't have. They have that ballot initiative where some interest group can get enough signatures to get something on a ballot, and they can whip up a frenzy of voters, and they can get voters to approve something that's really bad public policy because they can sensationalize it enough. And that's what they did with three strikes. That's what they did with a lot of things. That's what they did with Proposition 13 back in 78 when Ray Jarvis and his people went out saying about how oppressive the taxes were in California, and they passed Prop 13. I mean, so California, even though it's now a blue state, hasn't always been, and then it has the initiative of the citizens where they enact some bad things by voter referendum.
All right, so Mooney Mac in chat says, evaluate desired state's SO ranking system, i.e. tiered versus risk-based. I know that's going to open up a can of worms with you.
Okay, repeat that one more time.
It says, evaluate the desired state's SO ranking system, i.e. tiered versus risk-based.
Well, you really can't do that because many states, several states, have a tiered system, but they didn't do it correctly. And Mississippi has a tiered system, but everybody's lifetime. So what benefit is it to be a tier? If they actually did the tiers correctly, which few states have done, but if they actually did it correctly, you would have a group of offenders who would be able to be off in 10 years. It's technically 15, but 5 years for felony convictions and for completing treatment and a couple other things. And then you have a significant number who would be in tier two, which would be 25 years that they would be off. And there's no petition process required by the Adam Walsh criteria. It's merely those times pass and you roll off the registry. And then the tier three, which is supposedly the most serious offenses, that would be a much smaller group. And there is no way for those people to be removed. Well, obviously, everybody would like to have a way to be removed. So a true tier system is never a good thing, even if it's done correctly, because there's a group of people that are stuck till death. If you have a state that has that doesn't have a tier system, if it's lifetime and there's no meaningful removal process, Texas has a removal process. Unfortunately, no one ever gets off. They don't have a tier system, so Texas isn't all that hot of a place to be. It's not all that fantastic because the removal process removes virtually no one. California is creating a removal process that takes effect either this year or next year. Very few will ever get off, and they're going to a tiered registry.
Were you about to ask something? Owe me like a deep dive. You owe me a deep dive on that one.
We're going to do that one of these days, but it's a system. Well, it'd be great if we could get a Californian that actually understands how horrible it's going to be for those who try to get off. But I bet you no one in
California understands this because they think it's the best thing since sliced bread. You're the only one, Mr. Doom and Gloom again, thinks that it's like no one's like the scope of what it would cover is going to be so narrow that no one's ever going to qualify for it.
Well, now I have said that if you don't have a removal process and you create one, any process is better than no process. We'd all have to agree to that, right? Sure. If everyone's on for life and no one can get off and you create a process that theoretically let people off, that's better than what you had previously.
Certainly.
Because there was no theoretical way out. But what they've created in California is so cumbersome. You have to file with the police department first. You have to serve them your petition. And they have to clear you. And they have like 45 days to clear you to say that you're eligible, meaning you haven't had any convictions during your term of registration, which is, like I say, either 15, 25. And I'm not sure what they're doing with the longer people, but under the AWA recommendations, it's 15, 25 or life. And when you reach those mileposts, you don't have to file anything. The states are just allowed to let you roll off. But this is a nice money-making opportunity for attorneys because they created this process where you serve the police. Then the police give you clearance. They say, yes, we don't find anything in our criminal records repository. Then you serve the prosecuting attorney in the jurisdiction where you were convicted. And they get time. And because we wanted to be fair to the victims, they get notified and they get to have a say. And then the judge gets to decide. And the standards are so innocuous in terms of what the judge gets to decide. It's not that the person shall be removed from registration absent a showing by the state that they present a threat, is that the judge may remove the person and they may keep them registered. It's like a very mushy standard that the judge may keep the person on with very little showing by the state of anything. And they put all the burden on the offender to prove something, but yet it's very vague what they have to prove. And under that standard, with all those hoops, it would be a stretch for me to imagine that people are just going to easily get off. Of course, someone would get off. There'll be a few that'll get off. And I think in some jurisdictions, maybe where you have reform-minded prosecutors, maybe they won't be so zealous about fighting them. But my hunch is that there'll be a lot of, California's not all liberal. There are prosecutors that are very hard-nosed. I mean, I remember an attorney general that's now been elected vice president that was pretty hard-nosed on everybody. Can you call her name for us?
That would be Kamala Harris. Yeah, a bunch of our people are running around bitching about how terrible she was for just criminal justice stuff in general. Yeah, totally.
Well, and we did that on the podcast. We said that she needs to be held accountable. If she had an epiphany, that it would be nice to know what caused the epiphany, how much she epiphanized, and what she's going to do to try to move the reform forward, because she did everything she could to block it, and she said it was only me doing my job. Well, that's what everybody says. What they all say. But anyway, I don't think there'll be a whole lot of people removed in California, and that's why I gripe about that system. When you bring the victims into it, into a civil regulatory scheme, and they have to be heard, you've almost wrecked the train from the get-go.
Because I got you, man.
How many victims are going to come in and say, yes, we agree the person's reformed, they should be removed. They're not going to do that in all likelihood.
Sure. This last one I picked up off of Reddit. There is a PFR support, subreddit. And somebody's asking about sending Christmas cards. It says, I know there is a random act of cards, and I was also recently informed about a group that sends cards to isolated members of the LGBTQ community. And there are also a lot of us who are isolated, even from resources like this sub. Personally, I'm still struggling with connections and believe that I'm worthy of love. So I'm thinking of mailing out a dozen or so Christmas cards to random people from the list. I'm guessing I'm posting two questions. Does anyone see a possible legal hiccup here? And does anyone have any recommendations on who to pick? I'm probably going to send a few local to areas I know are isolated. Can anyone tell me where to look to find SOs that aren't allowed internet or otherwise pretty isolated? So my question to you is basically, is there any sort of legal challenge that you would run into? Because I know that many of the registry sites say you can't use this to go harass people. Could our people go reach out to our local registry sites and go randomly snag some people on the list and send them greeting cards for the holiday season to let them know that there are people out there that, you know, we still love them?
Well, first of all, I've never heard of anyone being prosecuted under that, under any of those laws. I've never heard of it. That doesn't mean it's not theoretically possible. I know that we have people that believe there's a hovercraft following them when they're on the road. And
don't you keep calling me about that hovercraft?
but that's because I pick it up when I try to track to make sure you're safe, and I pick it up on my tracking device that there's a hovercraft over you. But in terms of that, It would be a very bizarre prosecution, to say the least, if someone can you imagine the complaint would read as follows. It comes now the state of Georgia. They allege that about this date that the person used the sex offender registry to send holiday greeting cards to people who otherwise would not have had anything for the holidays. Can you imagine? I think even a jury in conservative Plains, Georgia would probably would dump that case. So I don't see that as being a realistic prosecution. But on the other hand, having said that, we have learned at NARSL, sending in unsolicited mail sometimes gets an unexpected. We've got a guy in Clayton County, Georgia, that has been rather adamant about us contacting him by mail. I think you're familiar with who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it has some downside risk to it, but I would like to think during the holiday season that even someone who really doesn't celebrate the holidays, they would give it the benefit of the doubt that the person was trying to be kind. And I don't think they would run to a police station. I think it would be a very kind thing to do. But remember, I'm not a lawyer, can't give legal advice, and if I were inclined to do it, I wouldn't hesitate based on that. Wouldn't come into my mind. I would hesitate because I would wonder if the people are going to react in a way that would be. Remember, you're going to send it for it has any credibility. You're going to have to put some kind of return address on it, right? I'm guessing. You know, it's not required by postal, but do you want them to be just totally anonymous without a return address and just think that they came from above?
Yeah, I don't. That part wasn't really described in there. I go through this forum and I look for interesting questions to lob in your direction to see if I can trip you up and go, man, I've never heard that before. Those are my favorite questions, Larry.
So, well, let's get back to latches. So,
okay.
I'm going to read
circle back. Very good.
Read to for legal deck. And I said it had to do with timeliness. And this is reading straight from the legal dictionary. The doctrine of latches is based on the adage that equity aids the vigilant and not those who sleep on their rights. In many situations, the delay in filing a lawsuit has the effect of preventing the opposing party from putting on a fair defense. This is because witnesses go their ways, evidence disappears, and memories falter. If a plaintiff has knowledge of a problem that might be a subject of legal dispute, but puts off asserting the claim for an unreasonable amount of time, he may be barred by recovering by this doctrine. So that's what it is. It's not the same as the statute of limitations, which is an absolute. But it's a legal theory that a person can put forward as a defense. Hey, he's known about this for all these years, and he should be barred by the doctrine of latches. But yeah, it can bite you in the rear when you sit on a claim that you know about.
Okay, interesting. Well, very good. So that'll be the legal definition of the week. That'll be our new featured segment, Larry. You have to pull out some sort of legal term that we got to share.
So, yeah, well, I haven't had to cite to latches in a while, but I knew it had to do with timeliness.
Groovy.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, Larry, it is that time. That time of like the featured segment of the evening. And so this is the Ninth Circuit rules in favor of registrants in ex post facto case. Which, funny, Florida spelled it CLASE, CLASE. How about that?
I've heard about this case.
All right. So we have some late breaking news for everyone, and it's an important case that was just decided by the Ninth Circuit. And I think you covered all of that stuff. I believe so. It happened in Idaho.
I think so, yeah.
God, I thought it was Iowa.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then I think we can really start with this.
Oh, great. Here we go again. I mean, I just know this was going to happen. You're going to be so pessimistic, and you're always like this. I mean, it is just sickening that you are so over-the-top pessimistic on everything you talk about on this podcast.
That is one of our patrons that was being a little critical of you. It says, try your best to be an optimist for once in your life, Larry. This is great news, and even you have to admit that, don't you? It's Christmas, and this is exciting that the Ninth Circuit has come into alignment with the Sixth Circuit, correct?
Not exactly.
Oh.
That is not what happened. That is not what happened.
Well, is it fake news then?
No, I wouldn't call it fake. There was a decision from the Ninth Circuit that was released. So that part of it wasn't fake. It's just that the analysis wasn't completely spot on in terms of what the decision was about.
Then what did it do?
Well, it didn't do much.
it says, there's 134 people or whatever that was that signed on to this thing. It had to do something.
It did do something. I'm going to focus mostly on the process because there was too many issues. There was too many plaintiffs and too many issues. But what this did was it reversed a trial judge's dismissal of the case. And we've had a lot of cases dismissed recently. And so people are hearing cases were thrown out. So that's what happened here. This case was thrown out by the trial judge. And those 134 people filed an appeal saying that the trial judge got it wrong. And that's, in fact, what happened. And let's just set it up with a story. Do you remember a case by Richard Glenn in Texas challenging the city of Louisville and their residency restrictions?
That's not the one with the home authority, whatever. That's not that one, is it?
No, this is the one where they had a party named Duarte. They had asserted that as family of registrants that they had standing, and they were challenging the city of Louisville in terms of basically about 95-97% of it was off limits. Some high amount of it was off limits. Richard Gladden made that challenge on behalf of the Duartes, and the trial judge dismissed it, saying that the Duartes lacked standing, and therefore we don't even need to get into this case. Well,
okay.
The place where the appeal would go in Texas would be to the Fifth Circuit, which is based in New Orleans. So he filed an appeal to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit reversed the trial judge and said, actually, the Duartes do have legal standing, and you need to consider this case on the merits, so therefore we're giving you order to reinstate the case. It didn't decide the case. It merely put the case back on the trial judge's docket and said, you jumped too soon. You didn't determine this case on the merits. You determined this case based on a flawed analysis of standing. These people do have standing, and therefore consider this case on the underlying merits. And that's what happened. It was very similar to what happened in the Duarte case out of Louisville, Texas.
Something in the news very recently, completely different subject matter. Texas is suing about election stuff, about how Georgia came out, and they've thrown the cases at saying Texas doesn't have any standing to say anything about the Georgia election. Not trying to go down that path, but it was thrown out for saying that they didn't have any legal standing, Texas versus Georgia.
That was correct.
Following any of that.
Yeah, yes, that is correct. And that was a predictable outcome.
Of course. You're always so fixated on words. It's obvious that something good happened here and that the Ninth Circuit found that trial court made some mistakes. This is what I was reading when I was reading through it, Larry, is that they said that this didn't, they threw it out because this was an error. What were those mistakes?
They did. The trial court did make. Remember, on an appeal to the circuit court, these appeals are decided by a 3-judge panel. So you'll hear people use the term the panel, and that's what they're talking about. So the panel of 3 judges held that the district court erred in dismissing the ex post facto claim on the basis that SORA was civil in intent and not punitive in effect. And specifically, the panel held that the district court erred by construing appellant's ex post facto claim as an as-applied challenge versus facial. And then they misapplied a standard of the clearest of proof at this early stage, and that was wrong. And then that the trial court found that the case could not win because Smith versus Doe was controlling, and the Ninth Circuit, the 3-judge panel, said no, Smith versus Doe isn't necessarily controlling, and so therefore these mistakes, this case needs to go to trial, and that's what's going to happen. It may not go to trial. It may be a summary judgment, but this case, it needs to go back and be decided on the merits.
We're getting murky. All right. The state filed a motion to dismiss, which was granted. Do I have that right, Larry?
Yes. Yes. That is exactly what happened.
And we've talked about a plethora of cases being dismissed lately. Why do courts dismiss cases? Is it simply that they don't want to be bothered? We've talked about the Supreme Court, like maybe 20 years ago, they heard 150 cases and now they're only hearing like in the double digits. Maybe they're just getting old and crotchety and lazy.
So, well, it's not what people think. They think that the judges don't want to be bothered. And what it is the litigants are arguing, the defending party, you cannot lose a case that you don't have to go to trial on. If you can prevent a case from being decided on the merits, there's absolutely no way that you can lose. If you're a defendant and the case is kicked out without a decision on the merits, would there be any way you could lose that case?
I guess I'm really trying to like piece your words together and play the scenario out in my head, but I have a case of the dumbs today and it's not working very well.
Okay. Can you explain that again? Okay. Well, then there's a great football coach that coached at the University of Georgia as defensive coordinator. He went to Georgia Southern as head coach, and he was a big defense guy. And he said to his team as a motivation, if they can't score, we can't lose.
Well, that's true. Sure.
Okay. Well, if you're served a complaint that you have to be a defendant in, if you can keep this from being heard, there's no way you can lose. If it never gets to court, there can't be an adverse decision against you.
I follow hockey. You can't get scored on if the puck is always on the other side of the rink.
Well, that's the same thing in litigation.
Yes.
As a defendant, you cannot lose if the case never goes forward. So therefore, your first strategy as a defendant is you don't take the loss and say, I can't wait to spend a bunch of money on having a 2-week trial on this. Your first reaction as a defendant is, how can I get this case to go away? Okay. Is there any procedural thing I can do? So if the state is the defendant, with the registry, rather than having an argument, they're going to first file a motion to dismiss, claiming that there's no way that if everything in the complaint is true, that it could be that you could prevail, that you're barred by various reasons. And that's what this court got wrong. It was argued that Smith versus Doe is controlling. That doesn't control because the state may the challengers may be able to distinguish themselves from Smith versus Doe. They weren't given that opportunity. And then on a motion to dismiss, the standard is not clearest of proof. And I can't even believe that a judge of any caliber would put that, because you don't need that standard. When you're considering a motion to dismiss, everything in the complaint is construed as true, because you're not having a trial. It's similar to the summary judgment. So right. to survive a motion to dismiss, the party making the motion to dismiss has to show that in every way you're barred, that you can't go forward. And the state, I don't put it past the state to have argued in their brief. I haven't read them, but they could have easily argued that the clearest of proof was required for this case to go forward. But that is not the case at all. And the Ninth Circuit said clearly that's not the case. You're supposed to take the complaint at face value. It has to be a well-pled complaint, which we're going to get to later. These complaints, even the amended complaints, were not particularly well-pled. But the well-pled complaint has to be assumed factual and true. And for you to survive that motion to dismiss, or for them to actually be granted that motion to dismiss, they have to bar you in every way to say that the law doesn't support you, the case law, the statutory law, you know, all this stuff. You're doomed from the get-go. And that's what this judge got wrong, that they were not doomed from the get-go. So this case goes back to the same judge, and that same judge is going to have to do a further development on the case before it goes away again.
Okay, I'm trying to put all your words together and figure out and make sense of it all, but we'll move on. Can you give me some background on Idaho's registration scheme? Can you people walk us through how registration has evolved in Idaho? I'm assuming that what they require today is not what it was like when it was first enacted, and that's pretty much the case everywhere, I believe.
That is the case everywhere. The state of Idaho began, according to the pulled this directly from the case, from the text of the case. They started requiring registration in '93, and it initially only imposed the duty on persons convicted of certain felony sex crimes to register with their local sheriff. But they didn't stop there. In 1998, they passed SORA, imposing the more expansive framework still in place today, designed to create public access to information about persons convicted of sexual offenses. I remember that was the year that the Macon's law passed by the Congress, encouraging the states to make their registries public. The 1998 act was applied retroactively to any person convicted of a newly eligible offense after July 1, 1993. And then after the 1998 amendments, Idaho legislature amended it again in 2001, 2002, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2013.
So almost every year after from 98, there's like only like 4 years in that whole run where they didn't amend something until 2013, and after 2013 they didn't. That's a lot of years that they amended things, Larry.
It is.
Well, what were they changing?
What the heck were they? Yeah, I was going to say, what the heck were they changing? Well, each set of amendments was applied retroactively in the same way as they did in 98. And in general, these amendments expanded SORA's framework, adding to the list of eligible offenses and heightening the obligation of registrants. SORA was significantly amended again in 2011. And as with prior years, the new offenses were added to the list of crimes requiring registration. There was also a significant increase in the amount of information required for registration. And, of course, that was after the Adam Walsh Act passed, so the state's moving towards complying with the suggestion of the federal government. And the registrants were now required to provide advance notice of any travel lasting longer than 7 days and to provide in-person notice of their presence to law enforcement in any jurisdictions they travel to. Now, that one really bothers me because I don't know how you can impose an obligation to do something in another state, but that's what they put down.
Can you describe that one a little bit more? So somebody travels from Idaho to, you know, someplace nearby. So they go to Colorado. They say that you have to follow the Idaho rules in Colorado.
That's what it appears to say. This is from the court, and I haven't researched this independently, but I'm assuming the law clerks at the Ninth Circuit are very good at what they do. And it says that to provide in person notice of their presence to law enforcement jurisdictions they travel to. So that is to be saying that we don't care what Colorado says. Their sheriff is only open once a week to collect registry information. You will do this because we say so. I don't know how they can claim that jurisdiction over you outside the state of Idaho. I don't know how they can do that. No longer in Idaho, you're in Colorado. You'll register in compliance with what they tell you, not what Idaho tells you.
Well, you know, I ran into those situations when I would travel, and they did not know, the handlers here did not know about the rules in these other states. So when you come visit Georgia, you would have to, if you were moving here, because this came up when the conference was here, if you're moving here, you have 3 days to register. But if you're just visiting, this is even vague whether it's 7 or 14 days. But if you're just passing through, if you want to go to the beach, whatever, and then you're out, you don't have to go visit the sheriff in 3 days. Pennsylvania is also different, but they said, well, no, you're going to be there longer than 3 days, so you have to go register. And I'm like, that's not what they tell me to do. Now, I know supervision is different, Larry. So the handlers can tell you to do whatever they want you to do, and you probably should comply. I'm just using this as an example of Pennsylvania didn't require me to register when I would go visit. So I wouldn't go register, and my handlers just kind of gave up bothering me about it. But they would tell me I would have to go register when I got up there. I'm like, they don't make me do that.
And I understand that. And what bothers me is that this would be in statute, because I don't know how you can control a person that's outside your borders. You're no longer subject to the regulatory scheme of that state. But anyway, that's what appears to be in the law. So.
Okay. And then all these amendments to Idaho's registration law sound eerily similar to what has occurred in many states, including Michigan. Did the Snyder case from Michigan play any role in the Ninth Circuit's analysis?
It did indeed. It was mentioned. And it's certainly not binding, as I remind people. That is a completely different circuit, and it's not binding. But they are certainly well aware that that case exists. They're aware of the fact that Michigan asked the Supreme Court to review it, and that the Supreme Court didn't, which was effectively an affirmance. At least you can credibly argue that. And in the Snyder case, quoting from which is what was in the opinion, they quoted this: a regulatory regime that severely restricts where people can live, work, and loiter, that categorizes them into tiers ostensibly corresponding to present dangers without individualized assessment thereof, and that requires time-consuming, cumbersome, in-person reporting all supported by, at best, scant evidence that such restrictions serve the professed purpose of keeping Michigan communities safe, as something altogether different from a more troubling than, that's why you should be reading, something altogether different from and more troubling than Alaska's first-generation registry law. Alaska's registration law didn't require much. That's why it was upheld. Right. It was very non-intrusive. And people keep saying the Supreme Court said you can do anything you want to do. They didn't say that, folks. They said you can do that.
This registry was okay. Yeah.
They said you could do that. And in fact, they fired the warning shot over the bow on page 100 of that decision. They said, if this is constitutional only because it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. And for some reason, the law enforcement apparatus has gotten away with saying, well, the Supreme Court, every time they come up with a new list of amendments. Now, let's go back. How many years straight was it they amended it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, about 13 years straight of amending the law. Everybody was being told that we can do this because of Smith versus Doe. And I will guarantee you there was not a single advocate standing there saying, well, no, actually, you can't. Smith versus Doe doesn't stand for that. Smith versus Doe actually said you can do it because it's not imposing any disabilities or restraints. All these things you're proposing in this legislation are disabilities and restraints. You can't do that in a regulatory scheme. There was nobody there. But anyway, this did come up in the decision. And it's the basis for the Ninth Circuit saying you cannot just rest your laurels on the on Smith versus Doe, because they just might be able to distinguish themselves based on what was pled in this complaint. So it's kind of a warning shot to the state of Idaho that you might not be on as safer ground as you think you are in defending this registration requirement regime in our state, in your state, I should say, because that's the Circuit Court of Appeals. They're not based in Idaho.
Yeah. You said that you read the dissent. Did you?
I did.
You don't ever read dissents. Why did you read this dissent?
I read this one because the potential is there that this could make its way to the Supreme Court. I do not believe that Idaho will just fold their tent and say, yeah, we got it all wrong. We don't want to do this anymore. If they would lose this, if they should lose this, it's got to go back through the trial judge level and be decided by a full-blown trial or summary judgment, which seems to be everybody's favorite way to resolve disputes. And one way or the other, then a losing party is going to appeal. You do not put together 134 plaintiffs and expect them to walk away and say, yep, we gave it our best shot at the trial court. We'll just walk away. On the other hand, you've got 134 plaintiffs. And the state of Idaho, if they lose, they're not going to say, oh, well, I reckon we'll just let it turn over the other cheek and walk away from this. So this is going to be appealed back to the Ninth Circuit again, regardless of who wins or loses. It's going back to the Ninth Circuit. And depending on what the Ninth Circuit does with it, it could be a cert petition to the Supreme Court again, because if Idaho should lose, they're going to do exactly what Michigan and Pennsylvania did. They're not going to say, oh, well, I reckon that's the best we can do. They're going to try every last, you could kind of look at the presidential challenges, whether there's about 65 of them now.
And I heard 50, court. But whatever, 65. Yeah.
So, I mean, they're not going to just go away and give up. So that's why I read the dissent. And I don't normally do that, but I did.
But back to the 134, I think I recall one of Janice Bellucci's had seven, probably does. Seven seems like a legit number to cover all of the bases of this person has this kind of specific one. And, you know, just give you a mix of people. 134, you've got some kind of pissed off people that were willing to sign on to it. Doesn't that add some level of impact to it that you had enough pissed off people to sign on to? I mean, you know, you're sticking your head up into the firing line when you end up on these court documents.
Well, I would say that'd be one way to look at it. Since I've never been a party to litigation that's this large, I don't even know how to. I wouldn't even be able to comprehend the undertaking this would be to put together a complaint that represents. The complaint would have had to have been extremely long, because each person's issues have to be pled separately in the complaint. And that brings me to the point of what the judge, the dissenting judge, said about the complaint.
Which is why they threw the kitchen sink at it. Even in the decision I was reading, they said they did everything, and it wasn't necessarily well filed, but they threw everything at it, saying that, you know, jaywalking is not a legit thing that you could do on the registry, and they didn't seem to like it very much.
I picked out a quote here. And the sitting judge, Van Dyke, I believe, was, "This is a difficult case, made all the more so by appellants John and Jane Doe's 1 through 34, woefully inadequate briefing. Despite repeated reprimands below," and there, he's referring to the trial judge, "the Doe's counsel continue to require the court to parse through pages upon pages of allegations, voluminous,
right,
to decipher their actual arguments on appeal. Indeed, when reading the documents, brief and record below, one wonders if they in their own version of spaghetti approach have heaved the entire contents of a pot against the wall and hope something would stick. This is what I tell people about when you throw everything at the kitchen sink at it. This does not go over well with courts when you do that, because it makes it too darn complicated."
So, and the judges at this level are not hearing new evidence. You'll correct me if I'm wrong here. They are basing what they are receiving based on what has been presented at the lower level. So they're not going to do fact checking. And it seems like it would be in our, as plaintiffs, kind of best interest to make it as easy for them to decipher all of the language as much as possible, for them to know what's going on, so they don't have to work too hard. Making them work hard would make them angry and not necessarily so much in favor of supporting what you're going after.
That's a one facet of it, but remember, there's a deeper facet that goes in this. The people make these laws through their legislative process, which everyone who is eligible to participate in has had that opportunity to do so. And to nullify the will of the people requires an enormous amount of proof of how someone has gone afoul of the Constitution. When you put forth a complaint, is complicated with all the different issues, and we've only touched on the issues here. We didn't even go into all the different things regarding the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and Idaho's version of that, and the Takings Clause and all these things that they wanted. When you do that, what you're saying is the people got it wrong over and over and over and over and over again, and courts don't like to nullify the will of the people to begin with, because the people are the closest. That's our system of government. We rely on people to self-govern and decide what they rules they want for society. So you come in and you have 20 years worth of stuff that you're unhappy with, and you have 130 plaintiffs, and you have 12 different causes of action, 12 different counts in your complaint of the things you're alleging are defective. You're basically saying the people got it wrong over and over again, and that's just a difficult pill to swallow for courts. You know, you need to be more sharply focused on what it is that you're trying to litigate. And they threw I'm not making this up. This is what the dissenting judge said about what he thought about throwing everything but the kitchen sink. He's not in a minority of judges that think that way.
Remind me, when you say disabilities and restraints, that takes us to the Kennedy Mendoza Martinez decision that you often reference. Is that right?
That is correct. That's
that has seven factors.
Has seven factors, and that is how something that's labeled as a civil regulatory scheme, as the framework established by the U.S. Supreme Court in '63, which is still utilized almost exclusively today by every reviewing court. They look at those factors to say, they can call it civil regulatory if they like, but here's what we're going to look at. And when they look at those factors, some look at them and liberally construe the factors. Some look at them. It would be like the Louisville case in Texas. That was a very conservative judge, and it was a very conservative panel on appeal in New Orleans. And they looked at it and they said, well, now that we're talking about, there is a constitutional prohibition against banishment. But banishment, as it was understood in colonial times, meant telling a person that they couldn't be in town at all. And as I look at this statute, they can be in town all they want to. They just can't live here. So this ain't banishment as banishment was understood in that time that those words were written. Now, that's your originalist interpretation. Well, that could be very much in play here. You know, it's like you, depending on how broadly you want to interpret or how narrow you want to interpret, the same review in court can look at the same facts, and one can say there's a constitutional intrusion and one can say there isn't. So,
and remind me, I believe you've said that there, one of those Mendoza-Martinez challenges is one that you are particularly fond of as far as challenging how the registry works. I think I've asked that the right way.
That, yep, that's always the disabilities or restraints.
Okay, you and can, that's where that comes can, from, because there are other things, you, obviously, but the disabilities, yes, and restraints.
Yes, there's that. To me, that is the key to winning or losing. If you've got a registration scheme that does not impose any disabilities or restraints, you're going to be hard-pressed to win that. I don't care what you try. If it's not requiring you to do anything, I bring up the draft over and over again. Young men,
just going to do
20, 18 to 26 years of age, they have to register for the draft. They're subject to felony prosecution if they don't.
Right.
They don't have to do anything else other than keep their address current with Selective Service. And they make it very easy. I think they can go online. I think we've got a young listener in the audience right now in chat that could probably tell us that. But I think you can update Selective Service online. But if you do not do that, you will forfeit various government aid, and you're subject to a felony prosecution that carries up to 5 years in federal prison if you don't do that. But it doesn't impose a single disability or restraint, and no one has ever argued that it's unconstitutional. I think there is possibly an argument that since it only requires young men, that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. If you're going to be subject to selective service requirements, I think everyone between 18 and 26, barring those who are exempt for whatever reasons, medical or religious, should have to register. But that's an argument, to my knowledge, that has not been raised, or at least hasn't been successful.
And to continue down that path just for a minute, making someone go to the registration office every 3 months sounds like some kind of disability and restraint that you now have to ask your boss to take off work. Maybe you have transportation problems. It creates a level of hurdle if you have to do registration every handful of months.
That is one part of the analysis, but it would depend on depending on how rigorously the court wanted to look at that. Looking at that, giving the most lenient interpretations, would say, well, it's more frequent than a driver's license, but it's not frequent enough that it really impairs your life. Another court would say, well, that's a huge impediment. Yeah, you if you're constantly having to be in a law enforcement office every 90 days, that would be an extreme impediment. But when you stack additional requirements, not only do you have to be at the law enforcement office every 90 days, you have to be restricted in where you can live, where you can be present, who you can associate with. It goes on and on, all the requirements that they keep you. Mississippi, as we talked about earlier, you can't even have contact with your victim without you going back to the court that convicted you, and you have to get the court to grant you that permission. How often do you think they're going to do that? And the victim has to initiate it, the way I read the law.
Probably pretty rarely. All right, then.
I just knew it. You just can't help yourself. Even Christmas can't even change you.
What happens next? Does the case return to... What happens next? Is this the end of the road? Does it go to the Supreme Court? What happens?
It goes back to the district court with instructions to develop the case. And the district court's going to do whatever it decides to do in terms of bring the counsel of the parties together and deciding if this case is going to go to trial, or I mean, it could be briefed and it could be decided on joint motions for summary judgment, or the state may file a motion for summary judgment, but the judge is going to be required to consider these arguments and rule on each one of them that wasn't dismissed. Now, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the dismissal of some of the claims, which it like it's too complicated. I don't want to try to get into it, but there are surviving claims that the judge is going to have to rule on, and who knows how it's going to be decided. I always hope for trials, but nobody seems to do trials anymore.
What exactly do attorneys do again if not go to trial?
They file motions for summary judgment.
Okay, I guess. Do you have any parting thoughts on this before we then move into anything extra? We don't really have anything else to do. Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight about this particular case?
Well, it is a victory, and we're always glad to have a victory because the case is not going to be allowed to die. It's a victory, but it's a temporary victory. It could be that it turns just like the Louisville case. That trial judge got the case back. He made a decision on the merits, and he decided that his initial hunch was correct, that it was not banishment. It went up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed him. They said, by golly, this is not banishment. The people can be in town all day long. So this is not a foregone conclusion that we're going to win. But this is a case that, now that we're aware of it, for some reason or another, it wasn't on my radar. Now I'm going to be looking at it and trying to figure out if there's anything we can do to help the process along.
Okay. Interesting. Well, Larry, we didn't receive any new patrons this week, but I wanted to make sure to highlight that Brian, and I don't believe it's Brian in Louisiana, doubled his Patreon contribution, and I wanted to say so. Thank you very, 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 very much, and it is greatly appreciated. Doubled it, Larry. Doubled it.
Well, now that could go from $1 to $2.
That is correct, but this was not that, and it wasn't 3 to 6 either.
Oh, it was a nice little chunk of change, and I'm very appreciative. Was it the amount of a federal stimulus payment?
It was not stimulus money level either. It was not. Oh.
All right. Well, then since there might be another stimulus in 2021, we got to put that option again. When we find out how much it's going to be, we got to put that option up.
We're going to have to roll back to whatever the September episode was where you're like, there's another one coming. I was like, man, we need to go spend some money. I was like scheduling to go out and hang out with friends and whatnot and go have a big party. But no stimulus came. And you said it was coming, Larry. It's all your fault.
It is. So, but now I'm optimistic again that even with the change in administrations, we might get another stimulus. I mean, we need to get deeper in debt. $37 trillion is not really enough.
In chat, somebody asks, are we still on track for a 501c3? I have no idea what the process is, where we are, what the status is.
It's lagging because lethargy? Lethargy. Yeah, it's lagging. I haven't done the application yet, and it's really not that cumbersome an application, but it's going to happen. Yeah, we've probably missed $100,000 by now by not having it.
That is possible. Don't you remember when we first started? Someone asked if we had some kind of, they wanted to do a contribution through a trust fund, and I was like, I don't have any clue what you're talking about. But we weren't anywhere near to being able to receive anything like that.
Oh, well, we can receive it now. If they feel they must, we can take care of it. We have foundations that would receive it on our behalf.
Outstanding. That is all I have, Larry. So if you want to find the podcast, head over to registrymatters.co and you can find show notes. You can find instructions on how to join the live stream, find all the places that you could get the podcast. All of those things exist at registrymatters.co. Nobody left any voicemail this week, Larry, but of course it is your favorite place to receive questions. But how would they do that if they were so inclined?
Well, you would pick up the phone and you would call Sarah at the switchboard and ask Sarah to dial 747-227-4477.
And email is over at the Gmail. It's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And Larry, what is the best way for people to support the podcast?
That would be patreon.com/registrymatters.
I so very much appreciate your time and attention to detail and all of those things.
That is why I am here.
You missed your cue again. We're never going to get this right. We're going to have to have like some sort of Sunday morning extra training or something on how we can get you to coordinate with that one. Love you, Larry, you very much.
Thanks a lot. Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.